This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Rebecca Thiel speaks with a Western Michigan University professor about changes at the teen fangirl magazine Tiger Beat. But first, for nearly 20 years, faculty and students from Western Michigan University have been digging at the site of Fort St. Joseph in Niles. After 250 years, nothing of the fort is left standing above ground. But on Saturday and Sunday, the public can see what the archaeologists have been finding.
Got another one right here.
Next to the St. Joseph River in a city park, students use water to remove dirt from 18th century artifacts. It's hard, exacting work. WMUK's Andy Robbins spoke with Western Professor of Anthropology Michael Nassany, the chief investigator at Fort St. Joseph, and with Public Outreach Coordinator Liz Mantic.
What is Fort St. Joseph and why is it important?
Yeah, Fort St. Joseph was a settlement established by the French in the late 17th century. It's one of the oldest European settlements in the Western Great Lakes. And it was critical to the French. It was situated along the St. Joseph River. And so it really was a stronghold for the southern part of Lake Michigan. It was actively involved in the fur trade. It was a staging area for some of the French battles with some native groups. It was a place where there were priests who were involved in religious conversion. And it was just critical in a whole string of posts that the French maintained on their western frontier. It was just a very important place for them.
I believe it's sometimes referred to as the Fort of Four Flags.
Yeah, and Niles to this day is called the City of Four Flags. So not only were the French there, but the English took over the site in, 1760, 1761. And they held it briefly. And of course, it came under American territory later, but not until the Spanish came and took the fort over for a single day.
Did the fort look like what we're used to seeing forts look like in the movies and TV with the log palisades and all of that?
Yeah, and that's the impression that a lot of people have, right? The log palisades and even the block houses and so on. And early reconstructions, at least on paper, of the fort depicted it that way. We're really challenged to understand exactly what Fort St. Joseph looked like because there are no documents. I can't emphasize that enough. There are no documents. There are no descriptions. There are no drawings. Of course, there are no photographs of Fort St. Joseph. So understanding what it looked like is entirely dependent on the archaeology. So the very brief descriptions we have suggest it did have a palisade. We don't know how large it was. We don't know how many buildings was inside of it. We suspect probably most of the buildings were actually outside of it. It was just a small stronghold. And it's been difficult to identify this ephemeral line of posts.
How long did the fort exist physically?
Well, it was initially established as a mission in the 1680s, and it was in 1691 that a fort was constructed. And then it was in operation, occupied until 1781. So about 90 years, there were maybe 50, 60 people there, a commandant, soldiers, fur traders, a priest, a blacksmith, an interpreter, native women, French-Canadian women, kids running around. We know this because we have a baptismal record. And a marriage record as well. So we know the priest was marrying native women with French men and so on. And so 50, 60 people for almost a century.
If my memory is correct, after many years and the fort wasn't used anymore, its location almost became unknown.
So after it was abandoned, about 50 years later, the area was surveyed by the U.S. government. They were eager to survey the land so they could sell it. And surveyors walked very close to where the fort was. They made no record of it in 1827. The land was sold pretty quickly. The government was good at doing that. And settlers came in there in the 1830s and started plowing it. And as early as the 1830s and 40s, there were remnants of the fort that were turning up along the blade of the plow. And then local collectors were collecting at the site into the early 20th century. But over the course of the early 20th century, the river was dammed and the site became partly flooded and the area was used as a landfill. And so the exact location became forgotten. And it really wasn't until the 1990s when WMU was called in and using some leads from a local historian, Joseph Pizer, we were able to pinpoint the location, and then we were actually able to do excavations and actually recover physical remains of the fort. And we made the claim that Fort St. Joseph was indeed found.
As you mentioned, the present site of the fort is rather challenging from an excavation standpoint. What does that all involve?
Yeah, well, the river is still, the dam is still there. The river is still high. There's a flood pool behind the dam, and the site is seasonally inundated. So from probably fall into late spring, there's often standing water at the site. And we have a short window, usually in June, July, August, when we can get in. And even though the site is dry on the surface, the groundwater table is just centimeters of a foot or so beneath the surface of the ground surface. And so it necessitates us dewatering the site. Well, so we have these inch and a half PVC pipes that go into the ground. And in essence, we just pump water out of the ground and lower the groundwater table to allow excavations to take place. And we've been doing that for almost 20 years now. We have found some wood, some upright posts that are part of the buildings we've identified, and so that's exciting as well. So some wood and certainly bone is quite well preserved at the site, and that provides us with a lot more information about what they're eating and how they were building the houses.
What other kinds of things are you finding there?
Well, lots of everyday debris. So, you know, we mentioned that there was the military there, had a commercial function, and it also had a religious function. And so all of those activities are represented in, you know, religious medallions that were possibly inadvertently lost, or crosses, or these sorts of things. Objects associated with the fur trade, various goods that were probably intended to be traded to native peoples, like glass beads and other iron artifacts, like iron knives and axes and these sorts of things. The French maintained close relations with the native groups in the area. One of the things the native groups wanted was a blacksmith to repair their guns. We found evidence of where the blacksmith worked, so there are lots of gun parts on the site.
What does, a more philosophical question, if you like, what does archaeology in this kind of context tell us what historical records cannot?
Yeah, well, what archaeology really gives us is very much the texture of daily life. So the records that we have are were written by the priests. They're records of who was marrying who and who was being baptized. And the commandants also would have corresponded with people in Detroit or Mackinac. And they talk about their political ambitions or issues with native peoples or these sort of larger policy issues, if you'd like. But what was really happening on the ground is not recorded in the documents. And this really emerges just from the archaeology. Again, something as mundane as what people were eating.
And how did Western become involved in the excavation?
Well, just somewhat happenstance. I got a call in 1997, and the local people said, oh, help us find Fort St. Joseph. We said, yeah, we're happy to do it. We started rooting around in 1998, and we finally learned that, you know, people had been looking for the site for 100 years. They hadn't told us that. And sure enough, we got a little lucky. We dug a lot of shovel test pits in an area where other Michigan universities had also looked for the site, and we didn't find much. Some 18th century artifacts, but not evidence of the fort. And then a local collector showed up and showed us where he had been finding some artifacts, and sure enough, that was the location. We did further work there. And again, because it was so wet, it's an area that most archaeologists had avoided, forgetting that the river 250 years ago was about 12 feet lower. And so all the pieces kind of fell into place, and we've been doing it ever since.
In addition to yourself and other faculty members, the excavation is mainly handled by grad students?
Yeah, we have graduate students involved and lots of undergrads as well. You know, we run the project as an archaeological field school. And so undergraduates and graduate students take the course for credit, and returning students like Liz, once they have some experience, they come back in either an internship or in a staff capacity, a paid capacity. And I mean, it's a project that involves a lot more than just digging also. Not that that's not an important part of what we do. But we do lab work, and there's various sets of analysis and a lot of publicity for the outreach that we do, and that's what certainly Liz is more involved with. But and we also train others. Besides university students, we also train members of the public. There are opportunities there that Liz is also involved with that as well. So,
Liz Mantic, as mentioned, is in charge of that public outreach. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of the project.
Sure. So basically, one of my roles is to kind of engage the public in all different sorts of ways. So for example, during the summer months, we offer a lecture series at the Niles Public Library. So we bring in a guest lecturer, and each year for the field season, we have a theme. And this year it's focusing on waterways. We offer summer camps as well for the public. So we do a middle school camp, and we do a lifelong learners camp. And they can come in and they spend 3 hours in a classroom, and they're learning a more extensive history of the fort. And then the coolest part is they actually get to come work with the students and staff of the project in the field. And then our big cumulative event is our annual open house that we hold each year. So we're really looking forward to that this year.
You know, a lot of people's contact, if you want to call it that, with archaeology might be, you know, Indiana Jones, seeing a mummy in a museum or something like that. Do they find it? How do they react when they encounter the real thing?
I think they're pleasantly surprised by it. I think that they're able to see, you know, what we're really doing and how Hollywood kind of, I don't want to say misconstrues it, but it's just the reality versus the expectation. And I hope that we don't disappoint. I don't think we do, but it's just exciting for them to come in and see live archaeology happening, and for them to be able to feel like they're almost a part of the recreation of the history as well.
In a lot of scientific fields, you know, the public really is not involved in any way. Do you feel it's important to have that public connection with your work?
Absolutely. I think that it just shows them how things can are like how things are created. And, you know, we offer like site tours on Fridays we're going to be doing, so they can come and see and they get a feel for, you know, this is how we do it and why we do it. And here's, you know, how you can kind of be involved as well.
If someone comes to one of those site tours or to the open house, what are they going to see?
Well, they're going to see busy students hard at work. So they're going to see recreations of what life was like at the fort. They're going to see our different techniques and how we really just actually dig. And then, you know, we have at the open house, we have a series of like different events that they can go to. It's like a big reenactor history. So we have a bunch of reenactors that come in, and so they're able to kind of be able to, they portray, you know, really what life was like. And so they can get a better feel for being almost in the moment, in the present with them.
Certainly want to invite the public to visit us during the open house. I think they often feed on the students' enthusiasm as well. Students get really charged up about being able to share what they've done for the previous 6 weeks. And the knowledge that they have about archaeology and the local history and so on. And I think people really get charged up about that. It really demystifies the process as well. It shows how tedious it is and how exacting it is. And yet at the same time, we teach, you know, students from 10 years old up to, you know, up to 80 who involve themselves in the camp and so on. And they gain a new appreciation, I think, for what we do and how we do it.
Western Michigan University Professor Michael Nassany and Liz Mantic spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins. The public open house at Fort St. Joseph will be held this Saturday and Sunday in Niles from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Learn more about the project on our website, wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. The teen fangirl magazine Tiger Beat is going through some major changes. Last year, a group of 17 investors, including notables like TV host Nick Cannon and basketball star Kevin Durant, bought Tiger Beat for roughly $2 million. Since then, the magazine has a new look, a new website, and updated their content to better reflect today's generation of girls. Ilana Nash studies adolescence at Western Michigan University's Department of Gender and Women's Studies. WMUK's Rebecca Thiel sat down with Nash to talk about how the magazine provides a safe haven for young girls.
So for those of our listeners who have not heard of Tiger Beat, you know, what did it offer to young teen girls?
Tiger Beat magazine began in the mid-1960s as an instrument for introducing teenagers to the pop music of the day. Early issues were sort of very musically focused on important major 1960s musical acts like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. The magazine fairly quickly altered its emphasis to be more specifically about romantic fantasies about male pop stars for an imagined straight female teenage audience. So by the time the late 60s rolled around, if you look at early issues of Tiger Beat, and it's hard to find them, but there are some in archives here and there, late 1960s issues were really emphasizing domestic slash romantic fantasies for teenage and preteen readers. For example, I remember a story about the Monkees and Peter Tork, who was one of the four young men who was the Monkees. There was a story in a 1969 issue of Tiger Beat about how Peter Tork is a tortured soul who has problems and we should feel sympathy for him, caring for him in a kind of motherly, sympathetic girlfriend way. And the example of trouble that they gave is that poor, confused Peter was beating his girlfriend. But we need to have sympathy and understanding for that because he's young and he's confused. And when I read that, my hair stood on end. Then for a while, there was a pop group called Chad and Jeremy. And then there were stories about how Chad's girlfriend is the perfect woman for him because she acts like a little girl and he likes to correct her and put her in her place. And isn't that a sweet, perfect, symbiotic relationship? By the time I finished looking through old 1960s Tiger Beats, I felt like I needed a stiff drink. I didn't start reading Tiger Beat until after second wave feminism started. I was reading Tiger Beat 10 years later in the late 70s. The editors had really changed focus. They had started to put a little more girl emphasis into the magazines. Not a whole lot, but there was some coverage of female pop stars and TV stars. And they'd really gotten rid of the more toxic, older messages about serving whatever emotional needs your idol might have. They still focused on domesticity and romance. Here are your idol's favorite foods so that you can imagine you're cooking them. Here's a picture of your idol making his bed, just like you have to do in the morning. And by the way, isn't it fun to see a boy in his bedroom? Right, there was always a little undertone of sex, but undertone, right? Lots of stories about their families, their favorite colors, their last vacations. The idea of Tiger Beat was to give young readers not just information about musicians and actors that they liked, but to feed a specific fantasy of identification and love.
And before the interview, we were talking about your crush on Sean Cassidy.
Oh, thank you for making that public, Rebecca. Yes, when I was 12 years old, I was obsessed with Sean Cassidy. And Tiger Beat was the source of information to facilitate my imagining that he was a real friend of mine.
But this is a very common thing. This is very accepted. You know, why is this a common thing for teen girls that we don't really see with teen boys? We don't really see that same idolization of female pop stars, for example.
That's a really good question, and a full answer could be a very long one. I'll try to give you a briefer answer. The history of adolescence, which is what I've spent most of my adult life studying, has a very bifurcated path. One path for boys, one path for girls. The path for girls has always included a sort of fetishized in-between space. You're a little girl, but before you're a woman, there's a special space called teenage girl with its own pathologies, its own styles, its own interests. Popular culture caters to that. For little boys, there's no separate in-between space. Look at the cultural markers for little boys growing up. It's sort of like boy to man. First of all, teenage boys like romantic and sexual fantasies just as much as teenage girls do, if not more. But they don't have to bother with a special magazine aimed just at them. In fact, they wouldn't, because the history of teen magazines has attempted to launch magazines for boys, and they haven't sold. Because teenage boys aren't all that much into reading, apparently. I don't know. But the other thing is that they don't need it, because they've got Playboy. The teenage boys' magazine interests in idolizing the female form have an adult outlet that they just can hop right over to. They don't need that in-between space. And that's actually something that we've seen for years in other kinds of popular culture, too. How many movies have you seen in your life? How many movies did your grandma see that had a scene where an ugly duckling teenage girl suddenly goes through her makeover and then emerges as a butterfly from the chrysalis? And there was even a popular song in the late 50s, early 60s called From Bobby Socks to Stockings, about that interesting change that a girl goes through when she stops wearing bobby socks and starts wearing stockings. Now, how many songs have you ever heard about, I don't know, a girl singer saying about her boyfriend, "My baby had his first shave today"? You know, that doesn't happen. Popular culture doesn't create a special, set-apart, fetishized, in-between teenage space for boys. It always has for girls. The other reason I think this phenomenon has been important for girls more than boys, not to get too grim about it, but quite frankly, girls are sexually victimized more than boys are. And the problem for girls has always been, how do you experience desire and interest without becoming a target? The good girl is supposed to not have any externalized desire or interest. She's supposed to passively wait for someone to choose her. And if a girl goes out and says, "Hi, I'm in public and I'm crazy about this guy and I want him," what gets said about her? She's either a little bit nutty or a little bit slutty. And if you go out and say, "Hi, I have sexual interest now," quite frankly, there are going to be a lot of creepy old men who take you up on that in a horrifying way. So how nice it is to have a magazine that knows that you have desire, caters to your desire in a completely safe way. The boys in those magazines are always made to look wholesome. Now, in the case of Justin Bieber, his public behavior totally shatters that myth. This is the guy who urinated in a mop bucket in a restaurant once. But the idea in the magazines is that the boy you like is a safe, wholesome character who is not going to try to grab your butt or publicly undress you or do anything that actual males do to teenage girls when they're interested in them.
Last year, Tiger Beat was purchased by a group of investors for around $2 million, rock bottom.
That's a fairly low price for a media enterprise.
Talk about some of the changes that we're seeing to Tiger Beat now.
Well, I have not seen the newest Tiger Beat myself. I know that one of their driving desires was to make Tiger Beat more relevant for the internet generation, because fewer teenagers now, regardless of gender, are sitting around reading magazines. They go to the internet for their information. And we've already seen that different branches of the publishing industry have been winnowing down, going out of business. Newsweek is gone, you know. So Tiger Beat needs to update its presence, and I know that in some of its press releases, this investment group was saying that they want to relaunch Tiger Beat in a way that kind of combines a print culture with an online culture, so that young people will be more engaged and subscribe more readily. I'm also fairly certain, having looked at issues of Tiger Beat from the early 2000s, that the obsessive, old-fashioned heterosexual fantasy element of what romance is supposed to look like is gone. I would be shocked if there are any articles in the new Tiger Beat that tell you how to cook your idol's favorite meals, or how to have sympathy for his abusive emotional problems. That not so much anymore. So thank goodness there is some progress. There will be more emphasis now on female stars, probably a lot more visual and less text. I saw that happening even in the early to mid-2000s. Tiger Beat had turned into mostly posters, very, very short articles. And probably more emphasis, more evenly divided attention, I would say, between male and female stars.
There was also mention of lifestyle kind of content, what to wear to prom, that sort of thing. And then,
right.
You know, there were even articles mentioning LGBT
girls. Now, that is delightful. That is delightful. They're really trying to tap into what we used to call zeitgeist, the general cultural attitude of the time. And LGBT rights, just within our own lifetime, have suddenly become a much bigger deal that people pay attention to and care about. So I'm glad that they're trying to work some diversity into their magazine. I'm also glad that they're trying to sort of branch out to the more lifestyle stuff as well, because that will probably garner them a better audience. In the olden days, you could have more niche magazines because people were magazine readers. That was the primary way that young people got their information about the world. Most of them weren't sitting around watching the evening news because it wasn't addressing them, right? So there were magazines for every interest you could have. Now that we live in a less magazine-laden world, you can't afford to have that many niche markets. You have to sort of bunch them together a little bit more. So if Tiger Beat really can address these gaps between print culture and online culture, between just fan worship and lifestyle, between the past of only catering to imagined heterosexual girls to expanding that to the LGBT community, that's probably good ways to keep the franchise alive.
Is there anything else that we didn't cover? Anything that people need to know that we didn't talk about?
One thing I would say is that I think a challenge Tiger Beat is going to have to face now is that in the olden days, it had cornered the market, along with other magazines of its genre. The genre cornered the market on providing readers with a fantasy of relationship with their favorite stars. Magazines don't have that monopoly anymore. Now you can follow your favorite star on Twitter and see what they say with their own fingertips. You don't need a mediator anymore to have that kind of immediate access to your star. I mean, you'd still need a mediator to show you photographs of your star making their bed at home. But just the emotional sense of, I know this person, I could conceivably chat with them or read what they have to say online, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, that fosters the sense of identity and friendship that girls want with their idols. That is not something that Tiger Beat can rest on its laurels on anymore. It's going to have to work pretty hard if they want to become something that the internet alone cannot provide. And we'll see if they do.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Twitter, the fact that you actually could chat with some of your idols should they wish to respond. Or their
right.
publicist, depending on who's running the Twitter feed.
Exactly right. Every time a star tweets something, there are always comments, either shut up, star, you're crazy, or I love you, you rock, go girl. You have immediate access to a piece of the inner life of your idol. Magazines are not the go-to place to provide that anymore. So we'll see how Tiger Beat does. I wish them all the best. I like the idea of a safe space for girls to have a romantic fantasy at that age.
Well, Ilana Nash, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Rebecca. It was a pleasure being here.
Ilana Nash is a professor of gender and women's studies at Western Michigan University. She spoke with WMUK's Rebecca Thiel. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.